WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned into Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi. Welcome to the extravaganza. I don't know if it's much of an extravaganza this week, but hopefully you will enjoy the list of guests that we have and the content, the conversations that we will have. We'll start things off with, well, it's not the State House report because we're not going to have an official from the State House. We have Jared Valenzuela, the newest county commissioner, Plymouth County Commissioner. He'll join us. We'll get a take on how the first couple of months have been on the job and how things are going. Of course, don't forget, Jared also hosts a weekly program every Wednesday night, started at 6:15 p.m., the JV team. So we'll talk with him again about being a county commissioner. We'll go from Jared to Casey. Casey Sherman, best-selling author. We'll talk with him about his new podcast, which dropped today, podcast that he does, a true crimes podcast. He does with Dave Wedge, his partner. They've written multiple best-selling books together. We'll talk a little bit about that. Interesting enough, last time we had Dave in here, Dave was talking about the last days of John Lennon's book that he and Casey, along with James Patterson, wrote. We'll again see what else is cooking for Casey and the gang, as he's always hard at work. Hour number two, we'll start talking Beatles. It's funny, we're going from talking with a best-selling author who wrote something about John Lennon to talking the Beatles being the best rock group in music history. We'll do that with Merritt David James. James, he is a Broadway star who also co-wrote a song with Joe Walker about John Lennon. We'll talk with him about that and also talk about why are the Beatles seen as being probably one of the best rock groups around. Now, I kind of have a little bias. While I may be a fan of the Beatles, I don't know if I would go that far, but we'll talk with Merritt about that. And then we're going to close things out somewhat on a sad note. As folks may or may not know, former middleweight boxing champion, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, passed away this weekend at the age of 66. I have asked Jim Fenton, Jim covering many of his championship title bouts as a reporter, as a beat writer for the Brockton Enterprise, Patriot Ledger, nearly four decades in sports writing. Jim will come in and kind of talk a little bit about Marvin Hagler. He knew Marvin. He had a chance to see the big title bouts, whether it was against Thomas the Hitman Hearns, or his final fight with Sugar Ray Leonard. We'll talk with Jim about that. I'm grateful that Jim, who actually just recently retired in December, is going to be joining us and talking about that. So I look forward to that. But right now, time for us to step aside just for a moment as we will take a final look at what's happening out on the roadways, being brought to you by Brennan Smoke Shop. Online at BrendanSmokeShop.com with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, and Weymouth.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The expressway southbound, you're in the brakes from Southampton Street to Granite Ave. Northbound's a good clean shot from Braintree to Boston, about 10 minutes there. Routes 3 South and 24 South are both moving along, and 93 is delay-free either way between Braintree and Canton. This report is sponsored by the Transportation Security Administration. $1,000 sign-on bonus. That's what the TSA is offering at Logan International. Apply online at tsa.gov/TSO. Some conditions apply. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Lisa DiMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
I'm amazed at the number of you here in the Commonwealth that aren't aware of the tobacco flavor ban. All flavored vape and tobacco products are banned from being sold here in Massachusetts, including menthol. It's okay. You can always go to New Hampshire or stop by one of our 9 locations and pick up some flavored CBD hemp wraps. Grape, pineapple, watermelon, strawberry. That's right, we have a huge selection of full-spectrum CBD hemp wraps. It's just another example of our American ingenuity. Oh, and a very special thank you to Speaker of the House Robert DeLeo for 30 years on Beacon Hill. May your greatest achievement be sending billions of Massachusetts taxpayer dollars to New Hampshire. Billions of dollars for their infrastructure, their roads, their police and firefighters, etc., etc.,
etc., etc. Count them, etc., etc.
Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, and now on Bridge Street in North Weymouth. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Flavored CBD hemp wraps, dudes.
Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
And we return with the first segment of the evening. Traditionally, the segment is called the Statehouse Report. I've broken this rule a couple of times in the recent times. I am about to break the rule again, although this individual has worked on the state level in the past. He is in government, it's not municipal, he's everybody's favorite commish. You're also host of a weekly program here on 95.9 WATD, the JV team, every Wednesday night. 6:15 to 7 o'clock.
Always a pleasure to be on the airwaves, especially with the immeasurable South Shore radio talent that is Kevin Tachi and Community Access Television. Kevin, always a pleasure to be on Monday Night Talk.
I thought it was time to, I think I said to you prior to you getting elected, and then once you were elected, I'd like to have you on the regular. Again, I'm friendly with all of the county commissioners, Plymouth County commissioners, as you guys do a fantastic job in serving all 27 communities, 26 towns, one city of Brockton. How are things going since you've been sworn in?
It's going great. I have to tell you, Kevin, you mentioned my colleagues, Commissioner Wright and Chairman Hanley, have been wonderful. The administration, Treasurer O'Brien, have all been great, welcoming me, getting me up to speed. I feel comfortable hitting the ground running. It's a lot of work at the start right now. As you mentioned, it's a lot of communities, a lot of territory, but right now everything's going very well, and very grateful to be here to always extol the virtues of county government and what we do for our communities and continue to talk positively about Plymouth County.
I think the one thing that is lost on people is the importance of county government.
Yeah, it is. I mean, one of the things that Plymouth County has been doing the last year, and we got some new round of funding that potentially could be coming, could be about $100 million, coming to Plymouth County in the form of federal relief funds. If Plymouth County did not exist, if the county commissioners and the treasurer were not in existence, the $90 million CARES Act funds that we distributed to cities like Brockton, who were able to buy iPads for their students to remote learn, to the other 26 communities that have used those funds to cover expenses incurred by the COVID-19 pandemic, they would have not had those expenses covered. And there are other communities, especially communities with county government, that are looking on Plymouth County with envy by virtue of the fact that we existed and we took that money. I will as often as has been said, say against the recommendation of the state, against the recommendation of a lot of our member communities too. But I'm extremely proud of the work that we have done as a team. And I emphasize the team because we worked extremely well together in such a bipartisan fashion. It's fantastic. The team has worked so hard to execute this program and deliver these funds to our member communities. And that's, I've been saying since I've been sworn in, Plymouth County works for you. And that's an example of Plymouth County working for you.
So there is a remote possibility that we're going to see CARES Act Part 2 here in Plymouth County?
Yes, there is a remote possibility of that. As of the legislation that was passed last week, it appears that Plymouth County will be eligible for $100 million. And if the state feels heartbroken about that, because they were disappointed that the $90 million that Plymouth County had out of the CARES Act last year came out of the state's bottom line, it is my understanding the state has allocated $4.5 billion. Whether Plymouth County takes the $100 million or not, the state still gets its $4.5 billion. So I know there are some out there who may feel bad that the state lost out on $90 million out of the original $1.5 billion that they got. But if Plymouth County executes the $100 million in this current package, the state will be unaffected in terms of the funding that, that it receives from the federal government.
So if I used a food analogy, it sounds to me as though a ice cream sundae was ordered and the state was like, we want one and we want a cherry on top, but saw that you, the county, have an extra cherry and they want your cherry.
Yes, in a way. So what happened with the previous CARES Act funding was, like I said, I think it was $1.6 billion. You know, when you start throwing billions of dollars around, you have a hard time keeping track. But $1.6 billion was allocated to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, built into that legislation. And this is a national legislation. This isn't, you know, this applies all over the country, not just to Massachusetts and not just to Plymouth County. But in that legislation, it stipulated that governmental entities with populations of 500,000 or more can apply for a portion of those funds to administer themselves. Plymouth County and the city of Boston, and this was always the irony to me when the state and the media were going after Plymouth County, the city of Boston also took their share of those funds. And nobody, to my knowledge,
said anything.
Yeah, nobody said anything. Nobody told them they weren't capable of doing it. And Plymouth County did it, and its county government does, and to take it on a different route. Plymouth County has distributed those funds faster, and you can ask any one of our member communities, faster, and on the administrative side, more efficiently than, from what I can tell, the state has. We've been very transparent. You can visit PlymouthCountyCares.com. You can see exactly where every dime has gone, both our administrative costs, which I think are still under $1 million right now. You can see every community that's received funding. You can see what round, what phase. So yeah, the state was upset that we took that $90 million that came out of their bottom line that they could have used elsewhere. And I give credit to Chairman Hanley, the previous chair, Dan Pallotta, and of course, Commissioner Wright. They asked the governor straight up, will Plymouth County receive funding out of this program? And the state, and by Plymouth County, I should specify our member communities, not the county government, the member communities. And the state couldn't promise that. So I'm extremely proud of that program as the new commissioner. And I'm grateful that my fellow board members and my predecessor, Treasurer O'Brien, his staff, everybody at the administration level in Plymouth County executed that program. The difference has been night and day. I mean, everywhere we go, there are so many grateful elected officials and local leaders for what Plymouth County did. And we're looking forward to hopefully being able to continue executing programs like that for our member communities.
It seems as though you settled into your role on the county commissioners. What do you feel your niche is? What do you feel? You know, I feel that Commissioner Wright, her thing was getting a dredge and getting that program up and running. Dan Pallotta, I feel that Dan was restoring the fiscal house of the county, as with Chairman Hanley. What do you feel your niche will be? Are you still seeking it?
That's a good question, Kevin. I think it's a little bit of both. I know wherever I've gone in any organization I've served, especially ones that I've been elected to lead, which we are the executive branch of county government, the financial bottom line is always the most important thing to me. So continuing on that vein that Chairman Pallotta was in, I'm definitely finding myself being the trying to keep the fiscal house in order, and the fiscal house is. And again, that credit does go to the current commissioners, plus Chairman Pallotta, Treasurer O'Brien, keeping that momentum going. It wasn't too long ago, it was about 10 short years ago, that the county was frankly bankrupt and on the verge of insolvency, to a point where it would have been non-existent had it continued the way it was going. Continuing to restore, I think, you know, one of the things, let me backtrack for a moment, one of the things that I constantly got asked when I was running for this is, what is a county commissioner? I even quipped with Christine James during the debate. My goal in 4 years, and this is a big goal, is to never again do I want to have Christine James have to ask, what does a county commissioner do? And I think we're starting to prove that with programs like the CARES Act, with programs like the Dredge. And that's become a team effort. Commissioner Wright has been out in the county selling that program. I shouldn't say selling, but she's been promoting that program. And it's been working great across the county. And I've had a couple of meetings with East Bridgewater and Lakeville about potentially bringing the Dredge to their communities as well. So that's another resource that's available. For me now, it's a lot about appearing on your program and talking on other programs across the county about what we do, because a lot of people don't know. And it's not the most glamorous stuff, but it's important work. It's good work. And the benefit of having Plymouth County government still is proving itself day in and day out, especially during this pandemic. My goal after the pandemic is done is to continue to demonstrate to the communities and the residents of Plymouth County that county government is an effective and efficient governmental entity that exists that can serve them.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Jared Valenzuela. He is a Plymouth County Commissioner, also hosts a Wednesday night program, the JV team, with Miles Heger and Corey Welsh and many other folks who appear. I know State Rep Dave DeCoste is a regular.
Regular, yeah.
So I implore you to tune in as often as you can. You know, here we are. We're sitting in the middle of March. And do you feel as though you talk politics? Do you feel that the political waters have somewhat calmed since the start of the year? Or do you feel that there's still a simmering? Because we look what's going on with our governor here in Massachusetts, and there was an unpopular move in regards to the distribution of the vaccines and having people inoculated. Look what's going on over in New York. I wouldn't want to be Cuomo right now.
No.
He went from being a kind of a hero during the pandemic to this guy's going to be a big fat zero because of all these women who are coming out saying, hey, inappropriate touching and stuff going on, as well as with his numbers with the nursing home,
right,
that his aides kind of weren't, they were kind of disingenuous. Do you feel that that's the only ripple in the water that we're seeing politically these days? Or are there other things that you're hearing and seeing?
Well, that's an interesting question, Kevin. One of the things that is interesting in the sense when it comes to Governor Cuomo, and we had talked about it on my program a few weeks ago as well, President Trump took a lot of the national media attention, right? I mean, the tweeting and everything that President Trump did, it just endeared so much attention. There's no more President Trump. He's not even on Twitter anymore. So the national media can't even go to his social media and say, what's President Trump saying now, or former President Trump saying now? So that, I think he offered a lot of cover for what Governor Andrew Cuomo did. I find what is happening in New York very interesting to me, because I had been saying over the course of the year now that the way he was managing that pandemic was borderline criminal. And I don't mean to be hyperbolic or partisan, but when I look at the resources that was given to the state of New York, they built out the Javits Center in New York City. They had the naval hospital ship docked offshore, and they saw zero patients. And he took sick COVID positive seniors and he put them back into those facilities that were locked down to the outside public, and led to greater outbreaks and deaths, when really, I've been in government, as you alluded to, I worked at the State House. This wasn't really creative problem solving. Wouldn't it have made more sense to take those positive patients and put them on those naval hospital ships, sure, ship you didn't use, put them in the Javits Center that you didn't use? I think, unfortunately, Governor Cuomo and so many other political types were so determined to make, not make President Trump look bad, but they didn't want to take any federal resources because they wanted to manage it on their own. In spite of the fact that those federal resources were there to save lives, their decisions cost lives. So it's interesting to see that Governor Cuomo has it sort of coming to him. As it relates to the political climate, especially in New York, and what I talk to, I'm the national committee man of the Young Republicans too from Massachusetts. So I do talk to some friends out in the other parts of the country. Governor Cuomo is just not a good guy. He's never been one known to be, you know, people don't enjoy working for him. Obviously, now we're up to, as you said, 7 women who have been harassed in some way, shape, manner, or form by him. Mm-hmm. The record speaks for itself. I look at records and to that end, to answer your question as it relates to the political climate, there's a lot of simmering still, I think, especially in Republican circles. I mean, those are the you know, I'm a Republican, so I run in those circles. Mm-hmm. But even on the far left, there's a strong polarization in this country. And interestingly enough, I reacquired on vinyl Pink Floyd's album Animals. And I would encourage folks to listen to that in the commentary it has on society today, because there's a lot of people on both sides that are viscerally fighting each other. And I think there are people at the top, not even political, but big tech, social media, that thrive when you and me and others are at each other's throats. How that ends, how we fix that, I don't know. It's an answer I've been trying to find for years, because it's unfortunate to watch how polarized we've become. And for me, what I enjoy, pivoting it all the way back down to Plymouth County, is how well we work together, Republican and Democrat. And of course, we disagree on a lot of things and we tease each other on the national political stuff. But it's simmering, and it's going to be simmering for a while.
How about as far as what races are you looking forward to 4 years down the road to see if Donald Trump will in fact be a viable candidate to lead the Republican Party and try to retake the White House? Or are you looking, 19 months down the road to see if there's going to be a gubernatorial race? Yeah. You know, will Charlie go for a third term, or will it be Karen Polito's to try to win? Are there other, I've heard former state rep Jeff Deal's name mentioned about a possible candidate. It's out there percolating. I haven't confirmed anything yet, but right. I mean, is that another race? Is that something you'd be watching?
Oh, absolutely. To answer the 4 years down the road, I'm glad you brought up 22, because I always look to the next battle. Mm-hmm. And I've been saying to a lot of my Republican friends who, somebody told me about the, and this, again, a lot of my friends on the left make things up. Like somebody said, your right-wing friends think that March 4th Trump gets sworn in. I go, what are you talking about? I haven't heard any of this. I think what's important is, and I've been trying to stress this, Republicans, whether we believe Trump had the election stolen or not, whether we believe Trump was treated fairly or unfairly, whether we believe Republicans are treated fairly or unfairly, I will say Republicans as a whole, generally by the media, not by Kevin Tocci or WATD, but Republicans as a whole, almost anywhere else, are treated poorly. And going back to Andrew Cuomo, look at the media coverage of him versus Ted Cruz. You would have thought Ted Cruz covered up nursing home deaths and sexually harassed 10 right. women when he went to Cancun. So to answer your question when it relates to 24, I think President Trump, I've been saying, and this is just Jared Valenzuela talking, no connection or anything at all, I don't think he runs again. I think much like when Obi-Wan Kenobi tells Darth Vader, strike me down and I'll be more powerful than you ever could imagine, I think that President Trump will find being outside, he will be able to wield more influence than he was as president, or could as president. So I don't think he runs in 24. I think you're going to have a wide open field again for both sides. I don't think President Biden runs again in 24. So I think you're going to see
Kamala Harris,
Vice President Harris, and again, a lineup of candidates. I mean, the Republican and Democratic parties have set records for the number of candidates that have run in the last two cycles, whether it be the Democrats in 20 or the Republicans in 16. Bringing it back locally, there's a few interesting dominoes to fall. I think one of the biggest ones in Massachusetts that didn't fall was was the U.S. Senate Democrat primary last year. A lot of people sort of understood that Joe Kennedy was going to be elected to the Senate in 2020. He was not.
Oops.
So that said, though, that puts his plan, right, that puts his plan off. My understanding from my friends in the Democrat Party is that Attorney General Healey has had her sights set more on a federal office, a U.S. Senate office. One would have thought to replace Elizabeth Warren and join Joe Kennedy. Mm. Joe Kennedy's not there now. So that puts a lot of different things in limbo. As it relates to Charlie Baker, I'm not sure. I've heard from all sorts of folks that he's definitely running and he's definitely not running. You allude to former Representative Deal potentially making a primary challenge. That'd be an interesting thing to watch play out. I don't foresee within the Republican Party defeating Charlie Baker. I don't think there's a path to victory in a Republican primary. And I think the Democrats, though, there's really no path to victory should they take him on in a general election as well. So if Governor Baker decides to run, this is, you know, prediction time now. If Governor Baker decides to run for that third term, he wins that third term.
Yep.
But there's a lot of interesting dominoes, I think, that are standing, especially with the constitutional officers statewide, that it'll be interesting to see, depending on whether he does or he doesn't, you will see a lot of movement. Otherwise, if he doesn't run for a third term, there's going to be a lot of movement. You allude to the Lieutenant Governor Polito,
sure,
likely running for governor as well. So there will be a lot of moving pieces if Charlie decides not to run for a third term.
And let's not forget, prior to the pandemic, this was Charlie Baker was one of the most popular governors we had. He had fantastic numbers, polling numbers. So you can't doubt that. Did he have issues? Listen, I go to different restaurants here and there. I can recall a restaurant in Halifax that actually has a sign up that was very upset,
yep,
that he had reduced the number of folks who could be in a restaurant. And basically they're saying, you know, the sign outside says, Charlie Baker, you know, reduce your salary to 25% of what it should be. People were out, businesses were outraged. People were upset. And it's understandable because that's your livelihood. It'll be interesting to see. Who do you think you would see as a Democrat, possibly? I think you mentioned Kennedy. Is it possible that Kennedy would want to be a gubernatorial candidate, or does he try to remain in the race and become a U.S. rep or a junior senator?
I think senator is his path. This is kind of sound sort of flippant, but Kennedys don't work. Being the governor is work. And that's not to put down being a U.S. senator isn't, but it's a big difference between flying to Washington, making a speech, and I'm not meaning to minimize being a U.S. senator.
Sure, sure.
I don't see Joe Kennedy as a candidate for governor. I don't think that's his pathway. And I think Governor Baker has been able to really, and I shouldn't say him alone, because Governor Patrick wasn't really a super ideologue. He raised taxes, which is what Democrats do. But other than that, he wasn't really a hyper left-wing ideologue. Romney wasn't, Romney was a governor of Massachusetts, so he was what he needed to be at that moment. Now he is what he is as a U.S. senator in this moment, but I digress. So I guess my point is Joe Kennedy, and for a lot of Democrats that want to run for governor, they're not going to find the pathway to enacting a lot of, in some cases, the progressive agenda that they want to enact. They have to deal with the legislature, and the legislature has a lot of power. Obviously, it wields a lot of power, and they the president and the Senate president and the Speaker of the House generally work with Democrat governors the same way they work with Republican governors. So to that end, I don't see someone like Joe Kennedy running for that. I think you could potentially see Mara Healey running for governor, should Charlie not. But I don't see that as her.
State attorney generals. I mean, look at.
I don't think any of them have ever won.
None of them have ever won.
Any of them ever none won. I mean, Martha Coakley lost
she
twice.
She tried. She lost by a slim margin.
Yes, she did. She did. But she and of course she lost to Scott Brown. So as a Republican in Massachusetts, If the former attorney general is listening out there, run for something, please. Attorney General Healey, Attorney General Coakley, please run, because there is no surefire way for a Republican to win is to run against Martha Coakley. But you're right, Scott Harshbarger in 1998.
Correct, yep.
Tom Riley lost to Deval Patrick in 2006, the primary. He didn't even get out of the primary. Right. So you're right. Attorney generals don't translate well in Massachusetts. Why? I don't know. They're elected statewide. They're a visible position. But, you know, she might try the U.S. Senate, the United States Senate track, and hopefully she will remember you should stand outside Fenway in the cold shaking hands, because that's how you win
votes. Smart move, right?
It would be a very smart move in not putting it down.
As we wrap up this segment, anything you want to kind of touch upon before we exit out of this segment together?
Oh, Kevin, it's always a pleasure to be on. We'll love to be on as often as possible, again, to talk about county government. We're very proud of what we do in Plymouth County. We're grateful for the opportunity to talk about our successes and what we're able to accomplish. And, you know, we do so much that goes on behind the scenes. We have one of the best performing health groups in the entire state. We have the best performing retirement group in the state. We have funded our OPEB, other post-employment benefit trust, better than any other entity in the Commonwealth. So Plymouth County, when I say it works for you, it genuinely works for you. And again, always love being on Monday Night Talk. This is the first talk program I was on WATD. I'm always grateful for you for giving me the talk radio bug. You know, I owe that to you, Kevin, and always grateful for being on the air with you, too.
All right. Excellent. Well, we look forward to definitely having you back on.
You bet.
And maybe even crafting some access programs for you to
absolutely
get the word out there and share your knowledge and wisdom of what's going on, especially when it comes to Plymouth County.
Absolutely. Be happy to, Kevin. Thank you.
You got it. Jared Valenzuela, our guest on this segment. We're going to step aside. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
Yes! Yes! Dad, I am crushing this game.
Anthony, please, stop yelling. I'm about to sign on to a meeting.
Whoa! Check out that landing.
Anthony, please. Seriously? Oh, man. No internet. I have no internet.
Home. Work. Household bliss. Backed by Bluestone. Bluestone Bank. Let's get there. Together. Member FDIC, member DIF, and equal housing lender.
Go ahead, indulge yourself. Every Wednesday night, tune in to Talk with Francesca and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both. Because being connected feels good. It's contagious, and I personally want to spread it around.
Don't miss Talk with Francesca, Wednesday nights at 9 on 95.9 WATD. Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return with another segment here on Monday Night Talk. Thank you for keeping the radio dial set right where it is. Great conversation with a good friend, best-selling author, latest release, going bestseller, Last Days of John Lennon, written by Casey Sherman, Dave Wedge. I think there was one other writer who was a part of the team. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But we're here actually to talk a little bit about the dropping of a new podcast that dropped today. We have Casey Sherman, who is with us. Casey, thank you so much for taking time out of your uber busy schedule to kind of chat a little bit about today's news and the new podcast.
Yeah, no, always appreciate the opportunity, Kevin, and glad to be on with you.
It escapes me who the third person is.
I wonder. He's just the biggest selling author in the entire world. His name is James Patterson, and okay, writing the last days of John Lennon with a guy like Patterson is a once in a lifetime experience, and we enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you for hitting the softball over the fence, because the idea was to kind of give you a chance to talk a little bit about working with Mr. Patterson. I did have a chance to talk a little bit with Dave, but I wanted to get your perspective of working with Mr. Patterson and what that was like.
Yeah, Patterson was a big fan of our work. He had read Boston Strong, which became Patriots Day, and got in touch with our agent. And he asked us to put together, you know, three ideas for a true crime book, because he was starting to get into that true crime genre. And we wrote three ideas. I came up with the John Lennon idea because I just knew it was something that he would bite on and something that held great interest for Dave Wedge and I. And he did. He went in with, you know, both feet first, and writing this book with Patterson. We did, you know, all the legwork, doing all the interviews, and, you know, for me to get a chance to interview Paul McCartney was a once in a lifetime surreal experience as well. And to put all of the new information about John Lennon's last 5 years, ultimately we have to land on the tragedy of December 8th, 1980. But what the readers of this book really get a chance to hear about and read about is what John Lennon was doing while he was a recluse in the Dakota leading up to his reemergence as an artist.
You know, it's interesting. I love hearing you when you explain about certain things and go into depth. And where does this rank amongst the other books that you've already written? I mean, is it there where it doesn't have an order, but it's just yet another one that another story you've been able to tell?
Yeah, it's just another story we've been able to tell, and it's a big one, obviously. You know, aligning with the James Pattersons of the world, open our audience up, you know, to people that probably would have never picked up a Casey Sherman, Dave Wedge book before. So it was a great way to amplify our brand, if you will, but more so the storytelling, which is really what I care about. It's really getting granular with the story, learning as much about John Lennon, you know, as I did. And I was a big Beatles fan, Kevin, growing up, and thought I knew everything about the Beatles, but I didn't. And that's what the research is all about, which is such a strong and very important component to writing any book, is getting under the hood and you know, pulling out new pieces of information that you can't wait to get to your audience.
What's also interesting is, you know, during the Super Bowl, now while our New England Patriots weren't in the Super Bowl, an individual that you had a chance to write about, Tom Brady, you know, you wrote a book about Tom Brady. I actually heard your name up and down the radio dial. I believe that you did an interview or two talking about Tom Brady and, you know, the after effects of, you know, after he had won the Super Bowl.
Yeah, you know, we had our book 12 about Tom Brady came out in 2018, and it was a runaway bestseller, which was great. But when Brady left to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Dave Wedge and I revisited the subject, and we updated the book for our paperback version, which is out now. And we tell the story behind the story of why Tom Brady left New England. It wasn't just a parting of the ways. It was a very ugly divorce. And we get very granular in our retelling of what we learned during that process.
Now, did you cheer for Tom as he won that Super Bowl? Or?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I think every Patriot fan should have been cheering for Tom Brady when he won that Super Bowl. But, you know, we should have been granted the opportunity to see Tom Brady ride out his career as a New England Patriot. And that, you know, seventh Super Bowl should have been a New England Patriots Super Bowl, but Brady was not allowed to do that. And a lot of the blame is put at the feet of the coach, Bill Belichick.
Very interesting. Well, the primary reason why we have you here is to talk a little bit about saints, sinners, and serial killers. Talk a little bit about a true crime podcast. Where did the idea manifest to do such a podcast?
Well, you know, Dave and I have always been natural storytellers, and, you know, it's just a great way to, again, grow our audience and present our stories in a different and exciting way. Podcasts are incredibly popular right now, especially true crime podcasts, Kevin, but there's a glut of true crime podcasts out there, and it's usually these podcasts are hosted by people that have never been to a crime scene. They're just kind of web sleuths or Monday morning Sherlock Holmeses, if you will. You know, Dave and I are legitimate and world-renowned investigative journalists, and we thought we could bring a new immersive style of storytelling to the podcast space, and we're very excited about it. We feel like, you know, we've accomplished that goal.
What was it like to kind of put together the segments of the pieces, or at least kind of build the, you know, the story for your first podcast?
Well, it was great because you could, you know, incorporate a lot of different production elements into it, which was fantastic. So, you know, I was an old TV producer back in the day, and this was like going home to me. And I love the idea of people, you know, who may not have the bandwidth to sit down and read a Sherman Wedge book, but they can listen to our stories, whether they're in the car, whether they're going on a walk, or whatever they're doing. This is, you know, stylized and amplified to scare the listener, but entertain them. And that's what we do.
And this is strictly an audio podcast. Do you have a visual as well?
Right now, it's an audio only podcast, but we're going to be bringing in visual elements as we grow the podcast. We'll also be bringing in celebrity guests to talk about some true crime stories that they're really interested in. And you know, we're very excited to continue to grow the storytelling element of what we're doing here.
How are you able to splice and dice your time to be able to dedicate towards writing maybe new projects? Because let's not forget, you also have a production company as well.
That's correct.
How are you guys able to, you know, put your time into certain elements? I mean, how are you doing that?
It's difficult, but we have to do it. I mean, you know, I sleep for a few hours a night and get back at it. But I do it because I love it, Kevin. And Dave does it because he loves it as well. We're always eager to get new stories out in front of our audiences. And this is a great new way to do it.
What do you feel the secret ingredient is between you and Dave? Because, you know, there has to, in order to be able, you look at Brady and Belichick, they were together for 20 years. They were, you know, one was the brains, the other one was the general on the field. What is the secret between you and Dave to be able to keep producing best-selling books and then moving into other mediums to, you know, discuss and share your knowledge?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question. For me, I think we complement each other. You know, we've got skill sets that complement each other, and, you know, we get along great. And, you know, we always decided, you know, when we're having a debate or an argument about anything, it's always the best idea that wins. You know, so we have to pull our egos out of it a lot of times. And we do that, very easily. So it's been a great partnership that we've had, and we've been able to grow together. You know, when Dave wrote his first book, Boston Strong, with me, I'd already written 7 to 8 books. And, you know, getting Dave to learn how to be a writer, not just a newspaper reporter, was a really interesting journey. And he's become a fantastic book author.
So, you know, if you could you tease what some of your upcoming podcasts are going to be? Can we give a little bit of a description of what today's podcast is, that without giving away too much of the storyline?
Sure. Well, today's podcast, it's part one of two, and it really goes behind the scenes of our research on the Hunting Whitey book that became a huge bestseller last year. And the great thing about this, Kevin, is there are some elements of our research that we couldn't incorporate into the book. So this is a great way to provide fresh content for people that are interested in Whitey Bulger and organized crime. And, you know, our book, I think, is the definitive work in the Whitey Bulger space, because we answered all of the unanswered questions about his 16 years on the run and ultimately his murder behind bars.
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. That's a hell of a title. but, I mean, it sounds like it kind of gives the great description of what people are in for when they tune into your podcasts.
It does. And, you know, when people ask us, well, who are the Saints? And, you know, my response is the Saints are the investigators that track down these, evildoers, if you will. So as we go into the podcast, we will be telling the true story behind the Boston Marathon tragedy. And as you know, we wrote Boston Strong, which became the hit movie Patriots Day. So we'll compare reality versus fiction in that particular case. And then we'll really tap into some lesser known murders and crimes that are fascinating to us. And the ultimate public has probably never heard of these stories before. So, you know, we can't wait to share as many of these stories as possible.
Any of the stories of like the Jeffrey Dahmers or the Unabomber, will it be anything like that? Or are you going to kind of just stay regionalized with a lot of the stories?
It's a great question, Kevin. We this isn't a regional podcast. This is a national and international podcast. So we've got stories to tell from all over the country and all over the world. And if we do check off those big ticket crimes like Dahmer, like Jack the Ripper or the Green River Killer, we're going to be bringing new information to the fore when we do that.
Is there a favorite of yours, a true story that you're hoping to dig into and discuss with Dave, or is that something you'd rather not delve into?
Yeah, I'm working on a solo book project right now, and it's a book project that will ultimately also be a television project with Robert Downey Jr.'s production company. And it's called Helltown, Kevin. And it's about a serial killer that was preying on young women on Cape Cod back in the 1960s. And his name was Tony Costa, and he murdered up to 8 women, dismembered their bodies, and left them in shallow graves in a wooded area in Truro, Massachusetts. Now, growing up on Cape Cod, I'd always heard about the story, but because of my closeness to the Boston Strangler case, I didn't give it much attention. But when, you know, a few months ago when I was in Provincetown and sitting down with somebody that was intimate with the case, I decided to take a fresh look at it. And, you know, I recently obtained the autopsy and crime scene photos in the cases, and it's the worst I've ever seen. This is, you know, on a level of Hannibal Lecter and Buffalo Bill. We're talking about a real depraved killer out there. And one thing that I want to bring to that story is a storytelling element is the fact that two writers, Norman Mailer and Kurt Vonnegut, were obsessed with this story as it was unfolding in 1969. So that's the book I'm writing now. And when I'm finished with it and when it comes out, obviously, I'll bring it to, you know, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, and Dave and I will talk about it.
I think what's fantastic, kind of delving into that story, is that I'm sure that the forensics and a lot of the information has been updated. So there is some new details that can be added to it, yes?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and again, it's just a way that I look at these crimes. So I know I'm always going to glean a piece of information that even the investigators really didn't know about. I've been talking to one of the lead investigators in that crime case from the 1960s, and we've been going over certain pieces of evidence, and I've been raising questions that weren't answered in 1969, and now we're trying to answer those questions in 2021.
How can folks be able to tune into your new podcast, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers?
It's everywhere podcasts are available. So folks, go out there, find your favorite podcast network, type in our name, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, and let these true crime stories wash over you.
And how often will you drop a new episode? Is this going to be monthly?
We'll be dropping new episodes each week, every Monday. So our first season is a 10-week season. And part one, Hunting Whitey, dropped today. Part two will drop next Monday, and so on.
I want to thank you so much, Casey, for joining us and being connected to this radio program. I feel privileged that every time there's a new project, we have new things to share with our listeners here on the South Shore. And knowing that you're a South Shore guy, it's a perfect fit. So I thank you and Dave for always checking in every now and then to share your works.
Oh, Kevin, you're a great journalist and you're a great friend, and our conversations aren't interviews, they're conversations, which is what I love. So thank you for the opportunity.
Final question I would ask you is you got to be feeling great that it looks like we see a big light at the end of the tunnel with the pandemic. So that's going to be welcome news for you and the work you and Dave do.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we have to travel for what we do, and we can't wait to get out there again. So it's very exciting, you know, when everybody's vaccinated and everybody feels safe, we'll try to find that normalcy again.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, Casey, both you and Dave. If you are just tuning in, our guest has been Casey Sherman. He's here to talk a little bit about the new podcast available today, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. The first of 10 for season one, available today. A new podcast each Monday, so make sure you check it out. We're going to step aside. That's going to do it for hour number one. When we come back, hour number two here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
Dad, you think UFOs will ever come?
Well, I'm not sure they've ever been invited.
Can we invite them?
Yeah, but how?
Well, we've got a flat roof and Christmas light strings. We can spell out UFOs land here.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll hold the ladder for you.
Later that night, there arose such a clatter.
Dad, look out on the lawn! A UFO with a broken windshield!
Wow, better call Tiny and Sons. They'll replace that windshield and insurance pays.
Do space aliens have insurance?
Oh, they wouldn't leave home without it.
I'm Peter Brown from Tiny and Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. Our service is out of this world. Just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Okay, we return for the second hour of Monday Night's Talk. And we want to thank Casey Sherman for joining us and chatting with us for a few moments, talking about his new podcast dropping today. And wouldn't you know, joining me, walking through the door, I thought I was rid of him about 20...
You can never get rid of me, Kevin.
Well, truth be told, is the reason why this gentleman is joining me for this segment is that Jared will tell you that he's a self-professed Beatles honk, and when I told him that I was going to be having Merritt David James on to talk about a song that he produced and also talk a little bit about why the Beatles are probably one of the most influential and probably one of the best bands known to man, he said he wanted in.
So you bet. Yeah. And of course, you know, as I'm walking out and Casey Sherman's coming in, I have Casey's book. About John Lennon, it's been out for a few months, and I've had it for a few months, and I pre-ordered it. But do you think I've read it yet? No. But don't worry, I'm going to sit down and start reading that book soon. It's I think he co-wrote that with Dave Wedge and James Patterson. Looks like a phenomenal read, and I'm excited to dive into it.
Yeah, James Patterson, big name, and it was a big team up.
Absolutely,
and it's a best-selling book right now.
Absolutely, it's phenomenal.
Last Days of John Lennon. But here, talking more Beatles, we have joining us Merritt David James. Talk a little bit about the Beatles and why is this group the best music artist of all time? Merritt, of course, known for his works on the stage, joins us. It was funny because during the break we were talking with him about, I didn't realize that he actually was in School of Rock and he actually played the role of Jack Black. It's cool. So, Merritt, welcome to Monday Night Talk. Thank you very much for joining us to talk about this very important subject.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's so great to be talking to you guys.
For folks who don't know, and I tease you who you are, again, we're also going to share a little bit of your music that you actually had co-written and co-produced. Peace and Love Will Never Die. It's a song about a song for John and Yoko. And I guess we're going to play a little bit of that at the end. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and some of the things that you have done on stage and star and in front on screen.
Well, you know, it continues to be a great adventure. It's been about 15 years of my career since I graduated theater school, and I just went right on tour, and I did 7 different tours, and I got my Broadway debut with School of Rock. And went out on tour with that, and boy, 15 years flies by, doesn't it?
It is.
At the end of School of Rock, Jill Walker, who's done so much great work with the John Lennon tribute over here in New York, she approached me and had some lyrics and a semblance of the melody, and we collaborated on the song, and I finished everything out. And really, what she asked was she wanted to do something specifically for Yoko Ono, and the 40th anniversary of his death.
Sure.
And you know, in honor of his 80th birthday as well, she approached me and wanted to do this song. And you know, when we talked about it, she said, "Well, we wanted to tribute the legacy of John Lennon and the love and life that he shared with Yoko Ono." And I thought, well, that's kind of a tall order. You know, it's a lot to try and encompass. And I'm really happy with what we did, and I understand that Yoko Ono's very happy with it. I know Jill's very happy with it, and I'm very happy to be talking about it here with you.
Well, you know, we were gonna again. We'll play it at the end of this particular segment. But I think we're going to get right down into the nuts and bolts of this. And I'm going to ask both of you this, because I think I'm going to have to play devil's advocate here. We can't all be sitting here going, oh, yeah, they're the best, and gush over the Beatles. But I'll start with you, Merritt. Why do you feel that the Beatles were the best rock musicians of all time?
Well, I mean, that's a simple question without a simple answer. But I guess it could be a simple answer if you want. I mean, you can just start reading the stats and say they had 20 number one hits in the U.S. With 24 consecutive top 10 hits from 1964 to 1976. I mean, they did most of the great stuff that they did within 7 years. I mean, all of that stuff that comes out of them is just, it was like a machine. And, you know, to me, that's a simple answer to that question. But I think just in the way that they transformed, you know, a new sound for what we later referred to as the British invasion, the new sound that they brought over to the American culture did a lot for the direction of music way into the future that went past when the Beatles were just making history. So I think that they've got their stamp on greatness in the time that they entered. They had their stamp on greatness the time that they left, and they've still got their stamp on greatness even now. So I think it's one of those things that is a timeless group. And that is what makes them so great, I think.
Jared, what do you think?
Well, you know, Kevin, of course, everything Merritt said is ditto. And actually, I will say too, Merritt, how cool you've had a song that Yoko Ono has heard. I mean, that's pretty interesting stuff. One of the other things, too, to note, and I think a lot of people forget this, Kevin, everything the Beatles did, they all did before their 30th birthdays. I'm 32, and I have not anywhere near accomplished what the four of them were able to accomplish. I think what has made the Beatles great, and I think Paul McCartney has said it, they were kids making music for kids, and that music still to this day appeals to kids in a large sense. Of course, it's nostalgic for folks who were able to hear them when they were growing up. But the other, you know, the other thing I would enter into, aside from some of the stats that Mary mentioned, the Beatles were the top-selling band of the 2000s, and they were barely a few sales off of Eminem for being the top-selling artist of the 2000s, from the year 2000 to 2009. Billboard hasn't released yet the top-selling artist for 2010 to 2019 for the previous decade, but I can tell you they've released everyone except for the top five. They haven't released the top five yet. The Beatles are not anywhere in the top 95, which means they're in the top five. If Paul McCartney was number 100, the Rolling Stones 79, you know the Beatles were in the top five, and I think that the revolutionary aspects of the Beatles, when you think about how music is today, and not just the technical aspect of songwriting, Taylor Swift is one of the only ones left that writes her own music still, but when you look at the way music is marketed, when you look at tours, you know, you have events in shows at Gillette Stadium, Fenway Park. That didn't happen before the Beatles played at Shea Stadium. You will look at the aspects of marketing, dropping albums at certain times. That didn't happen before the Beatles. The self-contained songwriting, as I just mentioned. Mm. Singles. You know, the Beatles were remarkable. I mean, you had a sort of pre-patent way. You wrote the songs, you had the single. The single dominated the album. The rest of the album was junk, and you toured on that. The Beatles completely changed that, and I think what separates them as well, and some actually say it's a knock, because the Rolling Stones kept touring. All these bands kept touring. What I think is an advantage is the Beatles stopped. They explored the studio, and I, you know, I know songs like "Hey Bulldog," songs like "Tomorrow Never Knows," especially "Tomorrow Never Knows." The technical aspects that go into that song can never be reproduced. And frankly, with the exception of probably rap and hip hop for today, every other genre of music—pop, rock, alternative rock, hard rock, even metal, punk rock. can all be traced back to one singular source, and that's the Beatles. Great opening line, by the way, right?
Play a little Tomorrow Never Knows.
Oh, yeah.
That weird buzzing sound in the background, Kevin, is feeding old, I think, 8-track tapes into a feeder. Whoa. Lennon's voice is distorted, singing into a speaker that then fed into another speaker. That song, I think, in technical terms, could actually never be reproduced again. Like, the Beatles could not walk in and make that song again. I'm sure they disposed of the tapes that made that sound, and that's the, for me, one of the more remarkable parts of them.
So I would ask you, Mary, I mean, what is it about the Beatles sound that actually has transcended generations? Because as Jared is mentioning that, you know, it's even doing well in the 2000s, and you're talking again yet a few generations removed from when, you know, when Lennon was gunned down, and as the Beatles have lost members. What is it about the sound?
Well, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, we could talk for an hour about Easily. The sound. I mean, I love listening to that answer just now, and I was thinking about, you know, while you were talking, that, you know, they really have revolutionized the science. They revolutionized at the time the science behind recording in the studio. So when you mention songs like Tomorrow Never Knows, you know, they were messing around with the tape speeds to make Lennon's voice sound higher, and, you know, and really they were the first ones to use multiple tracks instead of just playing live in the studio. So that was a huge step into the future. And I picture them, this very strange comparison to make, but, you know, when I was in music school and we listened to, you know, Beethoven, they said, a lot of people think that Beethoven is what Mozart would have been if he'd lived. You know, he was playing very ahead of his time.
Right.
He was writing very ahead of his time. I think the same thing about the Beatles. In the same way I think about Beethoven, they're very much ahead of their time. And so they catapulted everyone into this new arena. And I think because they were playing ahead of their time is a huge reason why they're still so popular. And when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of the answer to that question, it's all about just, they could write a song. I mean, they could write a song better than, I mean, anyone today. The songwriting ability of that group is just so impressive. And even the chord structure, you know, I'm a little bit of a nerd when it comes to like the chord structure and everything. They love, they introduced, I think, the use of the minor four. And so that I try to do that in Peace and Love Will Never Die. I try to throw the minor four in there, just to add a nod to that. I love getting any chance to see Paul McCartney do anything these days. I can't say I always think he knows exactly where he is, you know, but you see that he just loves to play. And you can see that energy that he always has, just the love of music this guy has. I mean, we could talk about things outside of music. You know, I just watched the Tiger Woods documentary, and I'm like, you know, this is not a guy who always loved golf. Like, he was driven to be the best and driven to excel to the heights of being the greatest of all time, which he still hasn't reached. And only recently in his 2019 win of the Masters did I see a guy who loved to play. And, you know, when you look back at Paul McCartney or John Lennon, I see guys who love to play the whole time, you know? And that's something that makes it last.
Now, Mary, have you ever had a chance to meet Paul McCartney?
I haven't. I've had there's a couple friends of mine who did. There was one who they were in an a cappella group in college, and one of the guys lived near Paul McCartney. Like, they had a summer place near one of his places, and they went up and they knocked on his door, and he came out and he sang with them.
Excuse me? What?
That's awesome.
Yeah, right?
That's great.
Well, you know, I actually have a friend who actually, I believe, met Sir Paul McCartney I think he actually, he and a former state senator found their way to serve Paul McCartney with a citation.
We did, Kevin. So it was me, Merritt, who has actually had the honor of meeting Paul McCartney. And the state senator that Kevin mentions was the previous host of Monday Night Talk, too, so it all comes together. I will say this. People have heroes, they have idols, and Paul McCartney is mine. Aside from the music part of it, devoted husband, family man, everything about Paul McCartney, to me, is what I think people should strive to be. What was great about meeting him is when you watch him in interviews, you watch him on TV, he is always often quipped, "I'm a kid from Liverpool playing music." And he'd even stated a couple of years back, and I've traveled extensively to his shows, 13 shows and counting, 8 states, 2 countries. I've been all over to see Paul McCartney. But he's always said, you know, and he talked about retirement with Willie Nelson, and he actually quit. Retire from what?
Right.
The Paul McCartney you see on stage, the Paul McCartney you see on TV is the same Paul McCartney in real life. And I'll always say this, I don't know if Senator Hedlund ever did this in his career before, but he knows how much I love the Beatles. He knows how much I admire Paul McCartney. And he actually handed the citation to me to present to Sir Paul McCartney. So I often quip that what do the Queen of England and Jared Valenzuela have in common? We've both presented Paul McCartney with honors on behalf of our governments. Of course, the
I
one.
Love it.
And I joked, I love it. Yeah, and I joked at the end. I said to him, you know, Paul, Sir Paul, I know it's not being knighted by the Queen of England or anything, but it's the best we can do. And he said, no, I love it. It's for animals. We were honoring him for all of the work he's done for animal protection. And he was great. He was awesome. He was humble in real life. He actually talked with us for several minutes. I had a couple of friends with me, and he went over and introduced, you know, he goes, "Hi, my name's Paul. What's yours?" You know, and he was awesome. And the last thing I will say to your point about them being great songwriters, Merritt, think of it this way, right? We've seen supergroups form. I mean, George Harrison formed the Traveling Wilburys, sure, you know, years after the Beatles. Obviously, Crosby, Stills, Nash. They're solo acts that formed supergroups after. John Paul and George, and even Ringo, all had excellent solo careers. I mean, if you were to stack up their solo careers, they were highly successful musicians. They just happened to start together as the Beatles. Some have argued, and I think there's a little bit of this, especially as it relates to Ringo's success, that, well, they were successful because they were in the Beatles. Yeah, but no. I mean, Lennon and McCartney, certainly when they first started off, you know, a lot of the music was not critically acclaimed. You know, McCartney didn't really find his footing till Band on the Run. Although I shouldn't say that about Lennon. Imagine and Plastic Ono Band certainly get a lot of respect for John Lennon. But on their own, they were fantastic artists as well. You just happen to get 8-10 years of them together, creating, again, what I consider to be the greatest music ever made.
If you're just tuning in, that was Jared Valenzuela sitting and co-hosting with me, and we have Merritt David James, who has co-written a song, co-written, produced, and vocalist on a new song about John Lennon and his death called Peace and Love Will Never Die. And he's been actually featured in roles, national tours of Beauty and the Beast. You played Hanratty in Catch Me If You Can, is that correct?
Yeah, I did Hanratty in Catch Me If You Can, and Sweeney Todd, that was a fun one.
Ooh.
It had to be the evil barber.
And I see Lord Farquaad from Shrek.
And he also got to be Robbie from Wedding Singer on nice. Stage.
That's what started my whole career was that show. That was a great time. And the party just kept going. And we're still having it today. Right now.
So he's our guest, and at the end of our segment here, we're going to play his song that he actually co-wrote about John Lennon, John and Yoko, a song for John and Yoko. We'll play that as we close out. But, you know, anything that we haven't touched upon in regards, do you get into conversations with people in regards to the Beatles? I mean, is that kind of, you know, if you're with folks socially distancing and you're talking about music, what other groups are brought to the forefront as you're making your argument for the Beatles being one of the best artists?
Well, I mean, I talked to, you know, Jill Walker. She just loves, you know, like you love Paul McCartney, she loves John Lennon,
right.
You know, and I have learned so much from this great, fantastic experience. First of all, I just have to thank, you know, John Lennon first and foremost for just being a creative lifeline in the last year that we've all just gone through. I mean, it's just it was one of the only creative things I was able to do. It certainly was the most significant. I did a lot of writing, and you know, I'm trying to find my own sound, and you know, that was a big creative element of my year. But really, the creative lifeline was doing this and getting to talk to people like you guys and Jill and, you know, all of the people I've met all across the country as we do these interviews. And there's just so much to learn about the Beatles, and there's so much to learn about John Lennon and every single member of the Beatles. There's so much still to learn about what Paul McCartney is doing today and how he's carried it on. And it's fun. Everybody has their niche that they kind of want to settle in and talk about, and I'm interested in all of it, you know. Of course, the only thing I wish is for, you know, because we're doing this for Yoko Ono as well, is I'd be curious to hear what you guys think about it. There's a lot of negative buzz about her, and you know, as I've talked to a lot of people, I think that's undeserved to a large extent, because you know, I think at the time there was a band that was headed toward a fork in the road anyway, and you know, I've always said that I don't think that the girlfriend of a member of the band would be able to break up a band like that. And if they could, then they weren't actually it was hanging by a thread anyway. So I'm always curious to hear what people have to say about that. I always do in these interviews like to give a good word for Yoko Ono, because after hearing about, you know, the life of a guy who seemed very unsettled personally, even with the explosion and the rocket ship that was the Beatles. I mean, what an amazing adventure that must have been. But to be as personally unsettled as I've kind of heard and learned about John Lennon being, to when he met Yoko Ono and he, as an artist, really found some contentment with her and some peace of mind with her. And I think that she did a lot for him personally. So I do like to give a shout out to Yoko Ono, because she's very much a part of the process that I've been involved in, and I'm always curious to hear what you guys think. Feel free to disagree. I just I'm always up for learning new things. So let me have it.
I think it's obvious that the folks who do not like Yoko have a grudge against her is because they feel as though she broke up one of the world's greatest bands. They feel that she was the wedge between the band and John, prying him away from that thing that made him so infinitely famous. But those are small, I hate to say it, but those are small-minded people. If they don't see that if she set him free as a person, then you know what, then the music he did after the Beatles was that freeness that he was able to exhibit. And if he was not gunned down so tragically as he was, we may have seen a Beatles reunion, but we will never know. We would have, absolutely.
I say that confidently.
What do you think?
I totally believe that.
Oh, I do too, Kevin. You know, Merritt, I agree. I think, and Kevin too. If you're a super Beatles fan, as we are, as I am, and you fall back on blaming Yoko Ono for the breakup of the Beatles, you're not really a super Beatles fan. As you touched on, there were already forks in the road. George Harrison was fed up. He had a massive backlog of songs that John and Paul would not let him put on albums. Abbey Road, George Harrison had the two best songs in Abbey Road, in my opinion, Here Comes the Sun and Something. And he tried to get a third song on there, All Things Must Pass, which, of course, ends up becoming, in my opinion, the greatest solo Beatles work. I think to blame Yoko Ono is such a cop-out for Beatles fans. Did she contribute? Yes. I mean, you look at the pictures from when she first started dating John. The four of them had a rule. John, Paul, George, and Ringo are the only ones in the recording studio. John Lennon, thank you, Kevin, cueing my favorite Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun. you look at the pictures, Yoko was everywhere. She was in the studio. She was in pictures, promotional pictures, with the Beatles. And you can kind of see Paul, George, and Ringo not really liking it. So there was definitely a contributing factor. I will say this. The legal structure of the Beatles is all four of them were 25% owners of the brand. Yoko Ono could have easily obstructed the other three in a lot of projects that have happened after, whether it be the anthology project that they did in the 90s, the Beatles Cirque du Soleil show, which Merritt, I don't know if you've been to Vegas to see that. It is hands down one of the greatest Cirque du Soleil programs, one of the greatest theater programs I've ever seen. Is it? I don't even if you consider it theater, but it's a great show. The Beatles Rock Band and everything else. She didn't inhibit the Beatles from moving forward in terms of the way they've been marketed and acted, been produced since John Lennon's death. She also didn't really overexploit John Lennon either, which she could have done. She could have really overexploited John Lennon. I agree. Yoko Ono gets a bad rap, and I think it's a simple-minded answer to what was. And quite frankly, again, they're all in their 20s. I mean, Paul McCartney had Linda. They grew older. At the end of the day, they had other interests. And yeah, Yoko was John's, Linda was Paul's, George's was, you know, his, and Ringo's was his as well. It was a natural thing to happen. We've all had friends that we've lost touch with, you know, but thankfully they sort of stayed friendly. At least Paul and John had a semi-reconciliation too. So,
Merritt, what would you say some of your favorite songs as we get ready to wrap up this segment and share information about where folks can hear your new song, you and Jill's new song in its entirety? What would you say are some of your favorite Beatles songs that stay with you to this day?
Oh, you know, everybody has so many different answers to this question, but my favorite is Come Together, and I think it's such a relevant song today, especially. And I actually heard, on a side note, I heard Garth Brooks, when he did the Chris Gaines album, he actually did a really cool version of Come Together where that chorus just pops in. It's another example of how you can use, you know, those great sounds in anything today. But yeah, Come Together, as you guys were talking about, Tomorrow Never Knows is one of my favorites, mostly because that really was a revolutionary song for the studio. That was the one that transformed the studio. So I love those two songs. I mean we could list every song we could list every album and go through why all of them are great. I mean, they're
exactly.
It's just one after another. It's just a machine of great sounds and you know, listening to everyone over this great adventure of learning about the Beatles, it's easy to step away as we analyze all of just the machine of the hits, and we analyze the new sound that they brought and the just the level of greatness that they played on. You know, I think you just said it best that they were a bunch of 20-somethings. Like, we have to remember, right, too, like, these guys were just a regular band. Like Paul McCartney says, I'm just a guy who likes to play music from Liverpool. Like, this yeah. is, you know, when we analyze the twists and turns of how they navigated their past, you know, there's many rabbit holes to go down. But I think one of the coolest things is that even in looking at how they would have dissolved or were heading to be dissolved, they did it as just a regular band of guys, and they did all of these great things with that very regular band dynamic between them, which I just love. That's one of my favorite things that I think has contributed to their sound, is they were just guys who loved to play music.
Absolutely.
Paul McCartney was just a guy who loved to play music from Liverpool. So I think all of that combination of the dynamic that they had and wherever that went and the sounds that they changed and pursued. I mean, they were going over to, what was that documentary where they went over to, was it India? They went over to India, yes. And there's a documentary about it, and some kid had a camera over there. It was just getting all this great footage of the Beatles. And they were just always in search of a new sound, which I think speaks volumes outside of music. You know, they were in search to better themselves and to variate themselves and the influence they had on the world. I hugely respect them for that. And I look at Paul McCartney as the echo of what was and the tribute of everything that is when it comes to remembering them. And you see it just in a pure love for music that he has today. As far as the song that we've written, I couldn't be happier. I couldn't be just more honored and thrilled to have gotten the opportunity to work on it. I want to take a second just to say, I can't say enough great things about Jill Walker. She has just been a musical angel sent from heaven in a really tough time on planet Earth. You know, she put all this in motion, and she has just been a great support structure and continues to be. And I will always look forward to working with her and to learning more about everything, because she is just a fountain of info when it comes to particularly John Lennon. The song, I hope that everybody goes to get it. You can get it on pretty much every platform there is. You can get it on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, YouTube. You know, just look for what you're into and you'll find it. If you go to Spotify, which a lot of people do, I always ask people to add it to their playlist, add it and be a monthly listener. You know, that really helps us out. If you're going to those other places, if you buy the song, that helps us out too. But and please feel free to find me on social media and tell me what you think of the song. If you loved it, if you hated it. Tell me why. Tell me what it makes you think about. We love getting feedback about it, and we just love when people get a chance to listen to it. And so that means we're just so appreciative to guys like you to give us a chance to talk about it, and then play it and share it with everybody.
Again, we've been speaking with Broadway star Merritt David James, and talking about the song that he co-produced and co-wrote with Jill Walker. As we head into the break, we want to thank you, Merritt, for joining us. And thank you, Jared, for sitting in
on the
conversation.
Thank you, Kevin, as always.
As we head into the break, here is that song, Peace and Love Will Never Die. This is a song for John and Yoko.
Not dear John Lennon's died, oh no. Somebody tell me why. Everybody else who knew everything that you'd been through said no, 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 it can't be true. But that woman who loved you knew. She knew just what she had to do. She made a circle in the world, a light in the dark, wearing all kinds of weather. People come together, leave a flower, sing a song. Well, John, you've been away too long, but we'll never have to say goodbye. Peace and love will never die.
The People's Truth, a show dedicated to bringing communities together and keeping the truth alive. Join your host, me, Benny Rabbi, as we talk with businesses, organizations, and people around New England and the world in search of the People's Truth. Join us tonight at 9 p.m. on 95.9 WATD.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Thank you for joining us for another segment here. And this segment is kind of bittersweet to the degree of the gentleman that I'm about to discuss and talk with is a somewhat of a friend, somebody who I've admired for years. I've read many of his articles, being a sports fan, regardless if it was some local sports that were happening or things happening on the national level, or him being a beat reporter for one of the sports teams, the Celtics, you name it. We have a legendary sports reporter, Jim Fenton, joining us, and we're here to talk a little bit about the passing of the marvelous one, Marvelous Marvin Hagler. His wife, Kay, posted a message about her husband's passing over the weekend, and the first person I thought to reach out to was Jim Fenton. And Jim, I want to thank you for joining me here for a few moments to talk a little bit about Marvin Hagler. Not only Marvin Hagler, the boxer, but Marvin Hagler, the person.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. It's definitely a sad day. And, you know, it's been a few years since I've seen Marvin. He hasn't really been around the city too much. And, you know, it's just brings back a lot of memories, a lot of good memories of, you know, what he brought to the city of Brockton. He put the city back on the boxing map after Rocky Marciano. And like, you know, it's just amazing that a city that size wound up with two great champions who are going to be remembered as one of the best in their weight classes.
I would ask you this, in your nearly four decades of sports coverage, what kind of a guy was Marvin Hagler? Anytime you had a chance to cover one of his fights or to interact with him?
Well, I was lucky because the Enterprise office was right across the street from the gym, the Petronelli gym. It used to be Ward Street, then they renamed it Petronelli Way. So, you know, whenever I'd see his car in the parking lot, 6 to 8, they'd be up there training. You know, I'd take a walk over and just, you know, sit down and chat with him and get to know him pretty good. And, you know, then you get to all the fights and, tons of media there. And, you know, he always took the time to talk to me. And he was, he remembered his roots and everything. You know, his the Petronellis and him, they were Brockton guys, and they wanted to represent the city as best they could.
It's interesting knowing that, you know, folks don't realize that while Marvin was not born in Brockton, he was a Jersey kid. He was born in New Jersey. Parents moved up here into the Brockton area, that, you know, how he got discovered by the Petronelli brothers, Goody and Pat. What is the story as to how that dynamic trio came together to be championship timber?
Yeah, he moved up here in the 60s with his family. And I remember Goody Petronelli told me they used to have the gym on Center Street. The building, I think the building's gone now, actually, but that was the original gym. And he said one night, Goody said one night he looked around the gym and there was a guy, young kid standing in the corner against the wall and just standing there all by himself. You know, he's probably 15, 16 years old. And Goody finally went over to him and said, what are you doing here? You want to fight? And he said, yeah, I want to fight. And that's how it all got going. He put him in the ring and, you know, they started him in amateur ranks and Golden Gloves. And he's a national Golden Gloves champion. And, you know, then he worked for them construction. That was part of the whole story. You know, he worked out all day in construction with the Petronellis, and then he wound up in the gym at night and, you know, years and years and years of fights and trying, and finally got his break on the international scene. And took him a while, but he finally got a championship fight. He drew with Antifermo in his first championship fight. And then a year later goes over to England and wins the title. And just a remarkable story how he basically came up from not knowing anything about boxing, showing up at the gym in downtown Brockton one night, and there he was, top of the world.
Yeah, you're talking about, you know, 67 fights, what, 62, 3-2. And you know, he fought, you know, when he fought, you were talking, that's when boxing was boxing. You look at boxing today, I think boxing it's kind of lost its way. But I feel as though we're fortunate to have had a guy like Hagler represent the city of champions, Brockton, Massachusetts.
Yeah, you get a chance, read a great book by George Kimball. He used to write for the Boston Herald. He wrote a book, The Four Kings, about that era, you know, with Hearns and Hagler and Lennon and Duran and how they were all interacted. And, you know, none of them ducked either one of them. They all fought each other and, you know, great fights, you know, Hagler, Hearns, who's going to ever forget that? You know, I remember being in the second row for that fight and just looking around at all the media and everybody just up on their feet for three rounds. And then, of course, the Leonard-Hagler fight, you know, everybody's still talking about that 30-something years later. So you're right. It was an unforgettable era.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the great sports writer. Jim Fenton is my guest, and we're talking, we're memorializing Brockton boxer, marvelous Marvin Hagler, as he passed away at the age of 66 years old. You reference the Hearns Thomas Hitman Hearns fight, and what a thrilling 8 minutes. But there was a point in time in that fight that Hagler could have, you know, if they wanted to call it off because he was bleeding, was there not a point where that Hagler was a little nervous that he could have lost his title right there and then?
He felt it actually in the third round. Referee Richard Steele had a look at the cut above his, I guess it was above his eye, above his nose near his eye. And, you know, Richard Steele asked him, can you see? And Hagler said, I'm not missing him, am I? And then after the fight, they asked him about the blood coming down his nose and how he fought through that. And he said, when I see red, I turn into a bull. And he finished Hearns off probably a minute after that. They stopped the fight. I mean, he had been through a couple, you know, the decision with Anna Firmo. So he knew he was at risk if he didn't finish him off, you know. So that was of all the events I've covered, that's going to be in the top three.
Definitely a thrilling time. And every time I watch it, it gets better and better. Knowing that he only had a few fights left after that, what made him finally want to fight Sugar Ray Leonard? Sugar Ray was out of boxing for a few years, but the story behind the scene was that Sugar Ray did keep poking and prodding here and there about possibly fighting Hagler. Was that the big fight that Hagler always wanted?
Yeah, he was always, I don't know if jealous is the word, but, you know, Leonard was the, you know, the golden guy from the Olympics and got all the commercials and everything. And even when he walked away from boxing in the early 80s, you know, he was still getting all the attention. And even because he was just sitting ringside doing commentary, he was almost as popular as Hagler was. And, you know, that was it. That would have been the crowning achievement to beat Sugar Ray Leonard. I think the Hearns fight gave him, everybody finally recognized him as an all-time great championship. But, you know, I think he realized that beating Leonard would have gotten that off of his back. And, you know, it's, of course, we all know how that ended and controversy and, you know, left a bit of taste in his mouth.
Watching that fight, how many times have you watched that fight to see if, in fact, Hagler won or if Leonard was the one, was victorious on points? Where do you have you found yourself on a seesaw? Or do you feel unanimously each and every time you watch it that Hagler won that fight?
Yeah, I think he probably won a close decision, but I mean, he gave away the first four rounds. I mean, to this day, I still don't know why they didn't send him out there and attack like he attacked Hearns. I mean, Leonard hadn't fought in a few years; he was rusty, and if you put a full assault on him in the first 30 seconds, he's going to start backtracking and maybe you get him hurt right away. But he just danced around for three or four rounds and got himself behind. And, you know, the middle rounds, he started fighting, getting his rhythm. And then at the end, you know, Leonard would just dance around and wouldn't get touched. And, you know, he won on style points, I guess, in the eyes of two of the judges. It was tough. I mean, it really could have gone either way. But, you know, being the champion and not get, I mean, he barely scratched the surface on Hagler. I mean, how do you take away a title from him like that?
Now, did you have a chance to get comments from Hagler or from the Petronellis after that fight? And what was their reaction?
The night of the fight, I think they were just stunned disbelief. And, you know, they couldn't believe that had happened. That was like their worst nightmare, to lose a close decision in a fight where Hagler hadn't been hurt or, you know, even been really taking too many solid punches. But I think as the weeks and the years went on, they really got bitter about the whole thing. And, you know, again, like I was saying before, the way to rectify that was to get a rematch with him and show once and for all who was the better fighter. And they chose not to do it. And Marvin's the one that chose not to do it and walked away from probably $15, $20 million at that time.
Do you think it was more about his legacy that while maybe he could take the decision, losing the decision, but what if he wasn't successful the second time around? Do you think that had anything to do with it?
It might have been. You know, the other thing was he was just probably bitter with the whole game, the Vegas at being in Vegas and losing the decision like that really upset him a lot. And I remember they sent me out to cover the Hearns Leonard fight. I think it was a couple of years after, well, maybe it was a year after Hagler and Leonard had fought. And if Leonard had beaten Hearns, they were gonna up the talk on a rematch. And Marvin was out there, and he just wasn't interested. It was unbelievable. He just didn't want any part of fighting again. And walking away from that kind of money is unheard of.
It's kind of interesting how he actually retired and walked away. I mean, he wanted to become an actor, goes to Italy. And I mean, it's kind of interesting to kind of go from being a boxer to going to another country to hopefully become a big name in, on the big screen.
Yeah. I mean, I could tell throughout his career, he got more and more comfortable in front of the camera, and he really liked the media aspect of it. And, he got a couple shots to do movies over there, and he was doing commentary on BBC for boxing matches in England and all over the country, Europe, actually. So, he found something he liked to do over there, and he was spending half of the year up in New Hampshire. And, he had quite the life for himself.
Post-boxing, how often did you have any interaction with him? Did you have a chance to talk with him every once in a while just to see where he was at?
Last time I saw him was at a Celtics game, maybe 4 years ago, three, 4 years ago. He was sitting in the front row. And before that, I saw him at the Campanelli Stadium. The Rocks, Brockton Rocks retired his number of victories he had. They put it out in the outfield next to Rocky Marciano's 49 for his 49 wins. And he'd be around once in a while, but he wasn't really in Brockton that much. He took up residence in Milan. He was over there for half a year, and up in near North Conway, up in New Hampshire for half the year. So he really wasn't around too much.
You mentioned about George Kimball and the book that he wrote. Interesting enough, I remember working at WBET with, I think, a mutual friend of ours, a late mayor, Bill Carpenter, who actually gave me the book, and I had a chance to kind of thumb through it and look at it. There was never a book written about him. Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. A couple people have asked me that. I don't think he was ever really interested in that for some reason. It'd be tough to get him to sit down for a few days and talk to him. So, maybe now, who knows? Maybe now it'll happen. But yeah, that's interesting how that never happened. His book's on everything now,
That is true. And also knowing that, interesting enough, his brother, Robbie Sims, still resides in the city of Champion. I would be curious how Robbie is handling things, knowing that his older sibling had passed away.
Yeah, I haven't seen Robbie in a while either. It's he put together a nice career for himself, living in that shadow, and had some big fights. He fought Roberto Duran out in Vegas, and Vinny Paz he fought. So I'm sure it's tough for the whole family, the mother and Robbie and everybody.
Putting it in the retrospect, how do you look at and how do you put Marvin Hagler's career into perspective? This is somebody who is also in the Boxing Hall of Fame, is he not?
Yeah, I went up there and I covered that back in the 90s, yeah. He was up there, he was inducted probably about less than 10 years after he went in, he finished his career. So he'll be remembered as one of the top middleweights of all time, Sugar Ray Robinson and, Monzon, certainly Carlos Monzon and Marvin. He lost three fights and the last one was controversial, and, he went years and years and years without even coming close to losing. So he made quite a name for himself.
Rocky Marciano was known for how he was amongst the people and with the people when he wasn't in the ring. How do you feel that Marvin left his impression on the people in the city? Looking through social media over the weekend, another individual you and I both know, John Marion, kind of talking about, you know, a great guy like Marvin and what he meant to the city. How do you feel that residents who remember him will, you know, share their thoughts and memories?
Yeah, he made a lot of friends in Brockton all the years he was there. I mean, started a scholarship fund at Massasoit Community College. He used to come back. He was here a few years ago for that. You know, they hand out scholarships to students from Brockton. And, you know, I remember going to Vegas and the fights, you know, you'd walk down the strip, you know, a few days before the fights and all you'd see were people from Brockton. I mean, they'd pack up and head out to Vegas for a week and bet all their money on Marvin to win. And most of the times, except for that last one, they won money. So, even over in Italy, I went to a fight in Italy with him, San Remo, and you know, it was a crew from Brockton over there making that trip to watch him fight over Mejia. So, you know, people really, they followed his career pretty closely.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned Massasoit, because I know an individual, a gentleman who had worked in the administration, Richard Cronin, who actually posted, I had put a post about Marvin's passing, and he actually mentioned that Marvin did give back to the community, so much so that he actually was a trustee for Massasoit Community College.
Yeah, that's right. He used to show up at the events when they'd give out the scholarships and give a nice speech to the students there. And, you know, Massasoit meant a lot to him.
Interesting enough, talking about his passing, as we have just a couple of moments left here, anything that we haven't mentioned in regards to the passing of Marvin and remembering him during this conversation?
I just think the hard work and dedication he put in. I mean, he proved that hard work and dedication can bring you a long way. I mean, he's a guy who kept getting frustrated throughout his whole career. I remember covering him at a fight at Roseland Ballroom in Taunton, little dingy locker rooms they had downstairs. And, you know, that was like 30 fights into his career, and he's still fighting in a little club circuit like that. Just had to wait, and he had chances to leave Brockton. I mean, the Petronelli brothers who had brought him in and gave him a job. And so, you know, he could have gone to New York with a different trainer, a different promoter, and, you know, maybe they could have speeded things up. But he was loyal to those two guys right to the end, and they used to call themselves a triangle. I mean, they were triangle strong, those three, and, you know, through thick and thin, they stayed together, and they wound up, you know, making big names for themselves in the world of boxing.
You know, it's interesting. We have a statue that the WBC gave to the City of Champions. Is it possible that maybe the WBC or maybe one of the other factions would be kind enough to have some kind of a monument in Marvin's likeness as well? Is that out of the thought of possibility?
I've heard that, you know, talk going around the city, you know, a few years ago after Marciano's statue was erected there. And I think there'll be a push now for it. I mean, somebody's going to have to step forward. It costs a lot of money for that Marciano statue. It's beautiful there. And, but it'd be something for the city to have the two of them side by side at the stadium there. That'd be quite an attraction for the city to have two world champions. And like we said before, two guys who are going to be remembered as the greatest of all, you know, two of the greatest in their divisions.
Before we sign up, is there one little nugget, one little memory that you have of Marvin, maybe a conversation you had with him or a story maybe he might have shared with you that still resonates to you, even more so now in his passing?
I wrote the story last fall. My wedding day was September 27, 1980, when he fought Alan Mitchell over in England for the title. And my wedding reception was winding down, and I heard a commotion in the other room, and they had the fight on. It was on Wide World of Sports, Howard Cosell was doing it. And so I snuck out of the wedding reception to go watch the last round. And fortunately, Marvin knocked him out in the third round, and that was that. I got back to the wedding reception. And a few years later, when I started covering him, I told him that story. And I said, thanks for taking care of him quick so I could get back to the wedding. And he said, that fight wasn't going to last long no matter what. So he was determined that day.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us to discuss this. I know you actually have a birthday coming up at the end of the month, so I want to wish you an early birthday, if I'm correct, right? You're a March birthday, yes?
Yes, I am. Two weeks.
What have you been doing since stepping away, putting your pen down as a sports writer? What you've been doing things to stay busy? Another life for you? What?
Unwinding, hoping the vaccine kicks in so we can start getting outside doing stuff and doing a little bit of reading here and there. And, you know, I'm going to take some time away. I've been working since I was 14, 15 years old. So, and this is my extended vacation right now.
Well, Jim, as always, thank you for your time. Thank you for your knowledge and your insight, especially talking about someone like a marvelous Marvin Hagler, who, you know what, a lot of people, he was a beloved champion, very much like Rocky Marciano. Maybe it was a different era, but it was still, he was somebody who was a man of the people. So I thank you very much for your time.
Okay, Kevin, anytime.
And that will indeed do it for this radio program this evening. Kind of a sad way to end, but I will tell you, I felt a need to talk a little bit about the passing of Marvin Hagler. Again, as a kid, I had a chance to see him several times as he was training to become world champion, and had chances to interview him, knowing that we were able to have the great Jim Fenton, you know, retired now from writing for the Enterprise and the Patriot Ledger. Great to have him here. And again, that'll do it until next week at 6:15 p.m. Please stay safe and have a great night.